From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on January 5th, 2018, when NPR's Robert Siegel hosted All Things Considered for the final time. Siegel retired after more than four decades with NPR, a career that included heading up NPR's London Bureau, interviewing presidents in the White House, leading the entire news operation in Washington, and then for many years as a host of ATC. Siegel once said that he knew he didn't have the voice of a Bob Edwards, but he wanted to sound authoritative on the air. Well, to my ear, Robert Siegel has the kind of voice that could be poured over pancakes if only you could bottle it. And more importantly, he brought professionalism and wisdom to NPR News for decades. Today, Robert Siegel is visiting Rochester and WXXI. Probably not how he envisioned his glorious retirement, but we're thrilled to have him nonetheless, and he's with us right here on it. Connections. This is what you thought.
This is a perfectly glorious day in my retirement, Evan. I'm happy to be back in Rochester.
We were talking before the program began that you are, just out of necessity, a little less plugged in, but what are your news consumption habits these days?
My news consumption habits are still two printed-on-paper newspapers that arrive in the morning, the Washington Post and the New York Times, a lot of reading newspapers on my iPhone, my smartphone, including some British papers, since I'm very interested, especially now, in Brexit and follow that pretty closely. Television, more cable television than I ought to watch for news, but
you
I still
don't.
Watch them. And some, you know, good old NPR shows. And also, I also either watch or listen to, because in Washington it's on the radio, the PBS NewsHour.
Now, when you say you're a little less plugged in, does that mean a little less stressed? Is it nice to not be by necessity plugged in?
Well, you know, I've said this so often, I bore myself with it, but people have often asked me, well, they used to ask me when I worked, is it a high-pressure job that you have? And I say, no, it really isn't. I've been doing it for so long that everything that could possibly happen in a studio has happened to me. I've been through it all. I'm not nervous in front of a microphone. The studio is a very quiet, peaceful place. The control room is a little nuts. The desk outside is really crazy. But I work in this bubble. So I thought that I worked in a very low-stress job. Then I retired and realized that the speed reading of those same two daily newspapers and consulting all of these other news sources online and on radio and on television and doing some stationary biking and a little bit of exercise and getting out on time for the meeting and reading a book because I'm going to be interviewing the author, not necessarily because I wanted to read that book, and possibly listening to a particular album of music, a CD, because I'm going to be doing a piece about that person, not because it's what I might most like to do. That I realized when I retired and I was depressurized that, yeah, I had I was really living under the pressures of my job all that time, and now not so. Now I've tried to figure out over the past year and a half what, now that I have this freedom, what do I want to do?
You want to come to Rochester, of course.
Come to
Who
Rochester?
Doesn't? Who doesn't?
It's top on my list.
But you say that, you know, when you were working those years, you didn't feel necessarily the pressure, that you didn't feel nervous in interviews. I don't remember a whole lot of explosive moments with you.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember Martin O'Malley was late to Diane Rehm's show, and she read him the riot act on the air. I mean, are there things that stand out to you over the years that were unusual?
Oh, you mean...
I know Mel Brooks cracked you up, but I'm trying to think...
Well, it's not that Mel Brooks cracked me up. It's that I couldn't get a word in edgewise with the man. I mean, I this is someone who I had, in my youth, I was able to recite entire bits of Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner from The 2,000-Year-Old Man. Loved Mel Brooks. Got a chance to interview him when he was up for a Tony for the songs he had written, the music he had written for the Broadway musical adaptation of The Producers, mm-hmm. which had already been a movie before that. And I was asking him the kind of questions we interviewers ask people. And everything I said, he said, Siegel, just play the music. So don't just play the music. And finally, he said, What time is this going to go on the air again? It was recorded. It's about 5 o'clock in the afternoon in New York. I said, okay. Around that time, the Tony jurors should just about be waking up from their hangover from the previous night's cosmopolitan stupor. They'll wake up. They'll tune in your show. they'll hear the music, and they'll vote me a Tony. That's what that's what we should do right now. And I said, and then I'll have a Tony, an Oscar, a Grammy, and an Emmy, and I can sell them on eBay for $100. Anyway, this went on. The actual recording went on for about a half an hour.
Yeah.
I think the piece was on about 7 or 8 minutes. But never did I feel so out of control with anyone in a recording as with Mel Brooks. And his constant interjections of, Siegel, just play the music. He did win the Tony ultimately. And he did send me a very nice autographed poster for the producers saying, sorry about Siegel! Exclamation point.
Well, you've been self-deprecating over the years about your own track record of interviewing political leaders, mostly because political leaders are so programmed.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we'll go into an interview. Journalists will go into an interview, and they will, and I've done this, you inevitably think, well, this will be the question that yeah. breaks some news or pushes them to get outside of their talking points bubble. And most typically, it does not happen that way. But I do think you've been a little hard on yourself. I think your approach has been productive and even-handed. But what would you tell young journalists in particular about the importance of or sort of the techniques of interviewing politicians?
Well, it's hard. I mean, because the politicians very often will have been interviewed more than the interviewer has interviewed people. And they've learned that they can stay on message and ignore your question. And at some point, you have to get good, better than I was, at interrupting the answer and saying, I know I've heard you say that already. But what about this? On the other hand, I think that the most important guidance I would give interviewers, a young interviewer in general, is to listen to what the person's saying and to be prepared to change gears. Because what you might hear in the interview might be much more revealing than the news break you had imagined in your head. For me, there was a very good example of that when I interviewed the Secretary of Homeland Security, Michael Chertoff, a few days after Hurricane Katrina had hit New Orleans. And he wanted to talk about the fact that water had been gotten through to New Orleanians who had been at the Superdome. And before going into the studio, it was a recording at about noon or something like that, I happened to turn on CNN, and they had footage of people stranded at the New Orleans Convention Center, people saying, nobody's found us. Nobody has found where we are. We have no water. We have nothing. And as I walked in, I sent word through to John Burnett, our very good reporter who was down there, to check this out. Was this true? And by the time I got into the studio with Michael Chertoff, Burnett was on the scene. And so I asked Chertoff, he'd wanted to talk about the great success we've gotten water through to people who'd been at the Superdome. I said, what about what we're hearing is hundreds, if not a couple of thousand people stranded at the convention center? He said, no, we have no, there are no reports of anyone stranded at the convention center. By this time, I was hearing through my headphones from the director or the producer of this piece that Burnett is there. He thinks he's counting 2,000, he figures. And I said, no, we're hearing actually from our reporter on the scene that there are people at the convention center who are stranded. And Chertoff appealed to me to not let rumors get out of hand. In situations like this, rumors can gain credence, and you mustn't be taken in by a story just because you've heard word of this. I pointed out that the reporter we'd sent to check this out is looking at it right now as we speak, and he's someone who's been covering hurricanes for years. We had actually sent him to Hugo and Andrew. He's been to wars, he's been to refugee camps, and he's telling me this is happening. And Chertoff just wouldn't acknowledge it. And what we learned at the end of the interview, and we put Burnett on afterwards to describe what he'd seen, at the end of the interview, I went back to my office, and an aide to Chertoff was on the phone, a young woman, who said, you know, at the end of the interview, the doors went open, and somebody gave the secretary the news that there are people stranded at the convention center. Could you please not use that part of the interview? since now he knows better. And I said, no. And I did lecture this young woman about working for the public and not just for, you know, for your secretary. And that we would acknowledge that after the interview, he was informed of this. What we learned in that interview was, which was I had not expected, was that the Secretary of Homeland Security, the guy who was ultimately in charge of the entire effort in Katrina, knew less about what was going on there than anybody tuning into CNN for 5 minutes, that the federal government just didn't have a handle on what was happening. And the press corps down in New Orleans, whom I joined the following day, I guess, heard this, and it led to a very tough interview from Michael Brown, the head of FEMA, the following day, because the cat was out of the bag. The federal government just had no eyes and ears in New Orleans. So the answers that I were getting were way beyond anything that I expected. I didn't expect that kind of incompetence or lack of resources. And if I'd gone along with the interview we had originally intended to do about what they had succeeded in doing, it would have been I could have missed the fact, which was not the substance of the secretary's answers, but the fact that he rather confidently described things as not happening that palpably were happening. Later on, when we'd meet, he said I was very fair with him. He said, he went on a big publicity campaign after that, demonstrating, rebuilding his reputation, which any cabinet secretary, I think, would have done. But rather graciously said, you were perfectly fair. When you dinged me, you had it right. You gave me a chance. And to me, it was a successful interview with a public official, a newsbreak interview with a public official.
Sure. Did you have, over the years, everyone has political leaders upset with them for one reason or another. Did any tell you they'd never be back, they'd never talk to you again?
I was once interviewing Senator Bob Dole of Kansas, who was the Republican leader, and I think the question was, would he filibuster against the Clinton health plan? I think that's what the question was, but frankly, I haven't gone back to see it. And I did what I was taught to do by an old CBS reporter in a journalism school class in a news interview, which was to essentially ask the same question over and over again, slightly changing the wording, because I'm trying to get a yes or a no out of him. And on about the fourth or fifth of my very pesky questions, he blew up and just said, "If I knew, I would not tell a crazy news organization like National Public Radio. I'm not going to tell you." And I went through this tantrum, and we said, "Well, thank you, Senator." And this was again recorded. I walked into the control room, and as you can imagine, my editor and producer were ecstatic with this interview. This is, this is great, great radio.
Great tape, they'd say.
And we ran it. But look, I said, look, here's the thing. You can't go from my first question. You cannot cut this as if I ask him once, are you going to filibuster? And he goes ballistic on me. Leave in my bothering him, because otherwise it makes no sense.
Gracious, though. I say that honestly.
It's honest.
There's a lot of power in editing.
Yes, and if you just took the clip out and ran it as a piece of actuality in a newscast without context, then that would be different from what you were having. I've learned since. Dole was given to such outbursts. I wasn't the only person he blew up at in that way, but it was a... I didn't have another interview with him after that.
My guest this hour is Robert Siegel, the longtime NPR host of All Things Considered, his career more than four decades with NPR, and just a tremendously important voice in American journalism, who retired in January of last year. He's visiting Rochester and WXXI today. As we talk about journalism and the state of journalism today, listeners, if you have any questions or comments, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. How many times over the years did you meet Donald Trump?
Never. I never met him. I saw one of his rallies in Iowa. before the caucuses. But I had never encountered him in his life as a builder, and in his life as a campaigner. I saw him once. It was actually a fairly rally that I saw was on a university campus, at University of Northern Iowa, and was a fairly upbeat, happy affair. Nobody was thrown out of the hall. There was about, I timed it, and I think it was about an 8-minute recitation of poll results, which I'd never seen any candidate, I'd never seen anyone do this in my life. It was strange. The music that they played before the rally was evidently selected by Donald Trump, and it was all from his salad days. It was all Rolling Stone songs from 1969 or whatever.
Well, you're a New Yorker originally.
Yes.
By nationality, as
By citizenship, yes.
By citizenship.
I'm a New York City citizen, yeah.
You have dual citizenship
with
the New York
State. And the United States.
The United
yes,
States yeah. and New York. And it was another New Yorker, Al Sharpton, who said last year, he said that the reason that there's been such surprise at Donald Trump across the country is, and I'm trying to paraphrase Sharpton and do it faithfully, his main point was, the rest of the country viewed Donald Trump in a different way than New Yorkers do. He said New Yorkers are very familiar with Donald Trump and his buildings and his portfolio, but Sharpton said we never really took him seriously. So he said the surprise in New York City was that the rest of the country might take him seriously because they viewed him as more of a circus act. Is that a fair representation of how New Yorkers feel, given that you're dual citizenship?
I think so. You certainly... there's another distinction that was offered to me by somebody who claimed to have predicted Donald Trump's election. It's P.J. O'Rourke. And P.J. told me in an interview that we did in part of this series, the Kentucky Author Forum, that I occasionally do interviews for, he claimed that he watched the Trump TV show, the Apprentice.
The Apprentice, yeah.
And therefore he said, people don't understand who this man was to the people who watched him. He said, everyone thinks they know that reporters never watch this show. He said, they think it's all about you're fired. He said, that's not it. He claimed that at the end of every Apprentice, Donald Trump would have a moment of parting with wisdom to people about running a business and how you do, and that he was on the program the epitome of the avuncular, wise entrepreneur who'd seen it all and could share this. He said, and that's whom people were voting for, he said. If you didn't watch the program, you didn't quite get who he was to his audience. You're right. He was a figure in the pages of the New York City tabloids for years, and I don't think his presidential prospects were taken all that seriously in New York.
Let me go ahead and get some feedback already from audience. Yeah. And Betsy in Brighton is on first with Robert Siegel. Go ahead, Betsy.
Hello, Betsy. Hi.
Hi. My question was, I was wondering how much training journalists get in pushing back against particularly political people who come on to spout some kind of predetermined talking piece. And I feel that sometimes I hear interviews and there's a little, they're just letting the person spew, which I think sometimes are alternative or spinning facts that aren't necessarily true, as opposed to holding that person to the fire. So I'm just wondering how much training journalists get in, or how much preparation they have ahead of time and knowing what facts they need to push back on.
Well, I think that if you have an interview scheduled and you prepare for it, when we're at our best, or when my former colleagues are at their best, you not only prepare for the questions, but you assume what kind of answers you might get, and have questions prepared to follow up with those. I saw an interview with Mike Pompeo that Martha Raddatz, a former NPR reporter, now on ABC doing Sunday. This week on Sunday morning. And she did a great job. She did a great job of following up. But this skill, and it involves the interviewer, it involves having the resources of a good researcher, is in knowing what the person is likely to say in avoiding your question, and knowing the facts of who actually said what, when did this actually happen, to be able to correct them when they misstate things. It's the more unpredictable the politician is, the harder it is to be prepared for the unpredictable statements they'll make. But it's—I don't know whether there's when you ask training, is there training? I think that in journalism, it's more you survive and move on better if you get good at this, and you're regarded as too soft if you don't. So you don't get those interviews.
And we all have moments in our journalistic career where you look back at an interview and say, boy, how did I miss this opportunity to follow up?
You bet.
I mean, that's part of the job. But Betsy, it's a good question. And our former colleague, Helene Biandouti-Hofer, recently said that she thinks it's surprising that journalists aren't trained in how to interview, not necessarily how to interview politicians, but how to talk to people and get interesting conversation to help us understand what divides us. So I think that's an interesting point. I find generally that NPR does that better because there isn't this crunch of a minute and a half the way commercial news. I just couldn't imagine working.
Yeah, I mean,
used to work in commercial.
Most of the interviews on NPR that you hear are recorded and edited. So there's been a one virtue there is that I can ask Bob Dole the same question five times so that if it yields absolutely zero, we just take it out and
sure.
We do leave it in one time. Live interviews, when somebody is being evasive or frankly dishonest in his or her answers to you, are very hard. They're very trying experiences. And I'm when you say trained, I think that at NPR there always were informal mentorships and training workshops that did address such things. But in the end, it's I think I was briefly a mentor to Steve Inskeep, but I can't tell you that I ever talked with him about doing an interview. He does them. He's a very aggressive, great interviewer. Are we trained? It's a good question.
Michael writes to us expressing a lot of what we're hearing in various platforms, which is just great thanks for your work. And I'll read Michael's email. He says, please tell Robert thanks for the excellent career at NPR. I think that ATC, Morning Edition are the best news shows ever, and I get most of my news from those two shows. And he says, I actually had a parking lot moment the first time I listened to ATC in 1978. A recording had just been released of Jack Kerouac reading his poetry. He was my favorite author, and I'd never heard his voice before. Huh. I actually had to pull into a parking lot because it was an intense emotional moment for me. Do you remember that?
I don't. Well, I wasn't yet on the program in 1978. I was editing it. I'm trying to remember this. I would have... Kerouac, is, of course, is one of the great Beat Generation writers who wrote On the Road. And famous, we would say now today, iconic figure, if we use today's vocabulary. But I can't remember that.
Let me get Tom in Fairport next on the phone with Robert Siegel. Go ahead, Tom.
Hello, Tom. Hi.
Hi, Robert. Again, many, many thanks. The previous email words are ones which I would definitely express to you. Wonderful, a wonderful career. Love talking with you.
Thank you.
You're very, very welcome, and I enjoy listening to you now. It takes me back. But, Robert, here's my issue. What can be done with both the print and the video, the television media, and when we look at horrific crimes in our country, why can't we all say to the print media and to the video, to the TV stations, please do not, under any circumstance, show the perpetrator. Care less what he or she looks like. I want the news media, both the print and the TV folks, to give more time to those poor victims. I want to hear about them.
Yeah.
I want to know. I want to walk in their shoes. I want to feel their pain. And all I can say is, I believe by pasting the smug, I'll use the word smug shots, not mug shots, out there is only encouraging those whose lives are lacking any direction or any caring to copy and do that. But, Robert, what will it take?
Well, Tom, I think you're describing what a number of news outlets have decided to do to limit themselves to one mention of the name of the perpetrator of a mass shooting and leave it at that. Now, let me just say, having said this, I have to confess to a journalist's curiosity that when these things happen, I want to know who it is. I want to know, is it a neo-Nazi? Is it some kind of a terrorist? What's going on here? And so while I get the idea of what you're saying, and I do think it's much, much more common now to at least keep it to a minimal reference to the name of the person who's been arrested, I have to confess that I'm one of those who's Googling to find out the name and to find out what might have motivated this person. And I confess to that perhaps morbid curiosity.
It's not quantifiable to know what the copycat impact would be, but it's not illogical to worry about that. Mm-hmm. And I think...
No, it's a worry.
I think that real discretion that Robert's talking about, Tom, is at the very least, that should be a minimum of journalistic standard now. Because just sort of purience and putting the picture and the name without discretion all over the place, I agree with you, is excessive. But to Robert's point, I think we're curious not just because we sort of want to rubberneck. We're curious because we want to understand what motivates and drives people.
Yes, if there were 5 mass shootings over the period of a few months and they all turned out to be the work of white supremacists, or they all turned out to be the work of Al-Qaeda sympathizers or whatever, that fact would have a meaning to me, which I would feel irresponsible not to take on board, and frankly, irresponsible not to report. That's not the case, and I don't really have problems with the minimal attention given to the shooters. That's now much more common. But as I say, I have to cop to an interest in who this person was when I hear about it.
My guest is Robert Siegel, longtime NPR News host. You heard him on All Things Considered for how many years were you on the air there?
31 years I hosted the program.
31 years.
Yeah.
January.
I was on the program before that, but I hosted it for 31 years.
31 years. January 2018, Robert Siegel retired from NPR News and visiting Rochester and WXXI, and we're thrilled to have him here today. This is our only break of the hour, and if you want to call the program, 844-295-TALK. We're right back with Robert Siegel next. I'm Evan Dawson, Monday on The Next Connections. The crisis in the Rochester City School District has become a financial crisis. We examine the latest information and what the district plans to do about it. Then in our second hour, Body Love, a film by a local filmmaker benefiting the Center for Youth. We'll talk about the themes involved with Body Love. It's all coming up Monday on Connections. My guest is Robert Siegel with us here in studio, and as Terry Gross pointed out, you went to NPR headquarters in the 1980s, and you were essentially the news director in Washington for a number of years.
I was, for 4 years. Yes.
And so I'm wondering if you were running the news department today, how you would feel about the increased call from some in the public for NPR or the New York Times or any outlet to be more direct and overt with these terms: lie, racist. You know, the idea is you have to say that that's racist. You have to say that this is a lie. And I know you heard that at times when you were there before your career finished up there at NPR, but how do you feel about that, Robert?
Well, I mean, my last season there, which was 2017, I remember the first time that I used the word lie in a lead or just saying this is not true, or this is, you know, and it didn't come easily. It didn't come easily. I was kind of raised on the journalism that someone would make an assertion, and then you would say something like, that was contradicted by the fact that blah, 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 you'd say that, and you would leave as the syllogism, the uncompleted syllogism, this was a lie, this was not truth. I found it difficult to use lie at first. I got more comfortable with it as 2017 went on. Racist is a little bit harder because it is less of a yes or no question. Is something racist? Well, many things may be racist in the perception of some people, and not racist in the perception of others. I do believe that the birtherism campaign, I believe, was at its core racist in some way, although one could make an argument for it that it was, I suppose it wasn't. I like to think of the post-Trump era of American media. I've asked some colleagues and other media about that, that this peculiarly hostile relationship between a president and the press, not as actually damaging in some respects as the Nixon relationship was with the media, but full of verbal abuse and insult and dismissing the media as enemies of the people and all this. I don't think this is the new normal of American life. I'd like to think that something at some point will subside to a more normal hostility between the press and people in office. And I would hate to see news organizations like NPR and the New York Times become so wrapped up in their criticism of public officials that the vocabulary of public discourse becomes toxic forever in this country, that everybody is either a cheat, a liar, a fake, is corrupt. And to my mind, those words are powerful, and when they're necessary, we've learned to use them without flinching, I think. Liar more easily than racist, I'll admit. But something in me is a little traditional about it, and would rather see us demonstrate the case for those words in a couple of sentences than use the words are less important to me than the demonstration in script that a statement is untrue, and it's the person saying it knows it's untrue or should know it's untrue.
Sure, and
it's not a very satisfying answer, I know.
No, but
I'm a bit confused about it.
I think the ongoing conversation within journalism is valuable here.
Yeah.
And I understand why some in the public are impatient with answers like that, but I think it's important.
I should say, I took part in the coverage of the Clinton impeachment. And ostensibly the question of that was, is Clinton a liar? You know, is he a perjurer? And I think in the end the answer was, most people in the country probably said, yeah, I know. I assume he lied about that, but I'm not going to. I don't think he should be removed from office.
But what I take issue with in the term liar,
yeah,
is that there's plenty of psychological study that indicates every human being in this country lies multiple times in a day.
That's right. You're right.
And every president lies. Every political leader lies. So what you're actually hearing from the public is, we want you to define that this is a new level and has crossed the threshold of acceptability.
Yeah.
But I think it's better to isolate case by case instead of, you know, putting an overarching label. Just like this president has done things that, to me, are very clearly racist. Yeah. I don't have a problem with saying it, but I understand why you're saying the hope is that this is not forever here.
And there is a distinction, as you say, between an action or a statement being either a lie or racist and the person saying it being designated the liar or the racist. I've never seen it at the source, but I once heard someone attribute a quotation to Samuel Johnson that from mere inferiority, nothing may be inferred. And meaning that when things are really low and bad, you can't really derive rules from these experiences. I think that was the meaning of it. And in a way, I think that the biggest national news media have behaved rather well during these years of being blasted for distributing fake news and lying. And I think that the Times and the Post, above all, some of the commercial networks, and sometimes NPR, a little bit less so perhaps, have been robust in their journalism and challenging statements of politicians and putting them to the test of truth. So I don't get the feeling that our problem right now is a deferential press.
Then there is a co-opting of by this administration of the idea that the press is picking a team or a side, and the president has used that to great effect. And so this notion of a perception of bias. With some routine, conservative Americans will say that the American news media is liberal or leans left, and they'll often say NPR, though I find a lot less evidence for that. But I want to ask you about something that the journalist Ezra Klein said about this. Ezra Klein said his feeling is that, especially when we're talking about national coverage, most journalists now live in and work in larger cities. And as a result, they're exposed to diversity of all kinds routinely. As a result of that, they are not necessarily liberal, but they are more cosmopolitan. They are comfortable with diversity. They see value in diversity. And that Klein views the media as generally, and as if the media is a monolith, but says it tends to be more cosmopolitan, less just politically boxable. I wonder if you agree with that.
I think that's probably true. I think also, you know, my friend Steve Roberts, who spent first a career at the New York Times, joined up early enough, young enough, in the very early 60s to remember when a newspaper newsroom, even at the gloried New York Times, was not necessarily staffed by college graduates, and that newspaper reporter was something you could become if you were willing to hang out and outside a police precinct and wait for stuff to hit the police blotter. That is, newspapering was at some level a working class job until a couple of decades ago, and now it's you're very likely to find people who've had elite educations and who've had, or at least extensive educations, and there probably is a journalistic outlook that is in some way conditioned by that. But again, I think that for the most part, and I don't like the phenomenon of all of the reporters who I think operate under great discipline and under tight editing, going all over cable television and all over Twitter, sharing their personal observations about everything, because I think it tends to reinforce all of these suspicions about the media that they're all a bunch of, before you get to liberal, they're all a bunch of self-serving, self-aggrandizing people who are just trying to sell whatever it is they're trying to sell. So Ezra's probably onto something there, and I used to have a whole shtick when I was news director, when people would always say I believed it, which was that journalism is a trade with an ism at the end of it, which it deserves because it is an ideology unto itself that can easily be mistaken for liberalism, because in fact there's a notion of afflicting the comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable, which at one time just seemed to be an all-American idea. Now that would be considered perhaps, you know, what are you advocating for the welfare state? It was a journalists tended to be very, very preoccupied with the new, obviously, and were we like writing about stuff that's new, that's often disorienting and threatening to people. We're libertarian at some level. If you're a foreign correspondent, while the business people and the diplomats and the military attachés are all quite happy with the way things are going in country X where you're based, the reporter knows the people who are being locked up for writing dissident editorials and feels the whiff of dictatorial rule before other groups do. And so we're very sensitive to that, and anti-authoritarian. And I said, as to the basic question of socialism or capitalism, as to the ownership of the means of production, most journalists probably think that a very, very wealthy family, a wealthy and somewhat eccentric dynasty of people, should pass the paper down from generation to generation, willing to lose money in a good cause to perform this civic function. So we were like feudalist in that sense. But all of this added together can easily be mistaken for a kind of political liberalism, which is too simple.
That's a very interesting exploration of modern journalism. Some more feedback from listeners. Alan wants to know, how do you deal with interviewees who run the clock? Kellyanne Conway is a master in her interviews, always ends with a smile on her face, running out the clock.
Well, it's not my problem anymore. I've never interviewed Kellyanne Conway.
You've graduated.
I graduated. The best way is to do taped interviews. What can I say? And to toss out the filibustering and just edit it out. We don't do that to the president, by the way. We never make internal edits on the president if we, you know, when we record him. I think that's still true. But it's awfully hard. And the best you can do with someone like Kellyanne Conway is interrupt and try to repeat and interrupt and interrupt. And I just saw, I think it was Judy Woodruff trying to do that. It may have been last night or the night before, with mixed results, I should say. It's the guest is, if the persistent guest can thwart an interview. I mean, journalism at some level, in some ways it can be phenomenally adversarial, and you're digging to expose things that other people want to keep hidden. But also political journalism can often just depend on a modicum of civility that if you're asked a question, you'll do your best to try to answer it.
Another listener wants to know what you think of the influence of Sinclair, which owns a station in this market, among many others.
How many others.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I remember the controversies over Sinclair's messages to stations. I don't know much more than that. I think what Sinclair is a part of is a very serious problem, which is that you have to live in an awfully big city in America to have commercial media that are locally owned. That in fact it's the public radio and television station that are, for many places in America, the only locally owned and operated mass media that you get. And the deregulation of broadcasting permitted companies like Sinclair to go from a maximum of 7 television stations to whatever it is now. I mean, however many, 200 plus they have. And I think that kind of control over local news suggests, first of all, some detachment from the real interests of the locality. You can't be that close to 200, I don't know how many different locations. And I think it's one of our problems with American media that there's too much distant ownership of local media.
Back to your phone calls. Robert in Fairport. I'm with Robert Siegel. Go ahead, Robert.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. There was an earlier question about politicians and some of the questions that they're asked and things like that. On this very show, we had an example of the mayor of Rochester trying to control access to get what she wanted. She was asked a question about whether she was under investigation by the FBI. And the host of the show asked the question a second time after the mayor avoided it the first time, mm-hmm, which is mm-hmm. what you recommended earlier in this hour.
Yeah.
The host of the show was rewarded with the mayor of Rochester basically blacklisting this show, and as well as keeping herself off the show, as well as keeping other people within the administration off the show. How do you handle something like that?
Good night, Robert. Is that an accurate account of what happened?
This was not supposed to be about me. That's pretty close to accurate. The mayor was on the program in July of 2017. She was running for re-election. She was pressed on this program about a number of issues. She was dissatisfied with what she perceived as the fairness or the unfairness, has not been back, and does not allow people from the administration on.
Well, I think what it reminds me of is I was disappointed to see journalism students being told by people in the business, in this case in the business of local television, of what you want to do. You don't want to have people coming and protesting at the station. This is what you do instead. You don't want to have, you know. And my unspoken reaction to this was, sometimes when you do your job, you will have people coming to protest at the station. The business of being a journalist might involve really ruffling feathers and people not speaking to you. And that's for the mayor of a city, that may be a violation of her obligation to the people of the city. But I think that it's if you're doing your job right, people will be angry with you sometimes. And I think as journalists get a little bit older, your skin toughens and you begin to realize, well, that's, you know, I guess we'll never be hearing from, you know, from that person again.
Yeah, that doesn't bother me. And again, Robert, just to try to wrap this up quickly, because I want to get back to Robert Siegel. That's why we're here. I'm not entitled to the mayor's time. Yeah. And if the mayor's decided that she doesn't find fairness in a certain program, that is up to her. And I don't seek to shame or belittle her on that. I just want to communicate directly to listeners. That's why you don't hear or see her here on this program or anyone from her administration. That is her decision. I seek to build bridges, not by being deferential, but by being respectful. And I hope that we can change that in the future. That's all that I need to say about that. Now, when you mentioned still getting two print newspapers every day, The Washington Post and the New York Times.
Yes, yeah.
And our colleagues in print, especially in local markets, smaller markets, are really struggling.
Yes.
What kind of model do you see as viable for the future of journalism?
Well, I mean, I want to talk about this a bit this evening when I talk here. First of all, we should be cautious about looking at the future of media. I mean, I've come to realize over the years that that what I may think of as the way things used to be was really just a snapshot of this constant process of change, and it happened to be in my salad days, so I remember it as having been that way. It's always changing, and NPR didn't exist when I made up my mind somehow that I wanted to work for a quality national radio network. I was very fortunate that such a place was created, so I can't foresee what's happening. But I think that the numbers of partnerships that are now taking place between different media, often with the public broadcaster in town, are very, very promising. And I think that the recovery of some local journalistic effort, which is really hurting at city halls and state houses all over the country. We've seen, bustling press galleries thinned out to just a handful of people doing coverage. I think that all around the country, various kinds of independent news organizations are aligning with, often, a public radio or public television station. And I'm sort of hopeful that this this way that we created listener support and civic institutional support for broadcast stations could become a kind of new multimedia hub for reborn media. The thing, one of the things that troubles me is that the newspaper is a lot of things. It's not just the front page. It's a crossword puzzle. It could be comics. It's obituaries. It used to be stock tables. They don't, who carries them anymore. So it's very hard for journalism to stand alone without some kind of a varied enterprise that it's part of. And I think that the public broadcaster, with a commitment to educational broadcasting and cultural broadcasting and music, I think may provide that big tent for information that a local newspaper used to.
That gives me a great deal of optimism, and I hope that's right.
Hope so.
We certainly feel that way here in public media. It was a number of years ago, and I did work in commercial television news, that a consultant told us that the public attention span was getting shorter. They wanted 30 stories in a 9-minute news block in the 11 o'clock news. I mean, the math doesn't really add up to much substance.
And
my hope is that what we've seen especially via public broadcasting, is that that was wrong.
Yeah. But here's what I'd say, because when I was sent to London by NPR, people at the BBC who were cutting pieces for American ears, they thought, one woman said to me, we've been told that Americans can't listen to anything longer than a minute.
What did you say to that? Well, I
said I'm here. Well, she was reacting to the fact that I was producing a reporter's piece that ran about 7 minutes at the time.
Yeah,
and I thought about it, and it something very important came to me, which was that NPR and All Things Considered in particular was not we weren't Martians. We didn't have a different planet in mind when we worked. We understood that, yes, Americans do have a rather, they expect quickness. But our 5-minute feature story changed voice and perspective and sound about as often as a 5-minute network newscast did. That is, the newscast began with an anchor reading the newscast, then some reporter came on with some sound from someplace. Yeah. Then the anchor came on, then the real production of commercial came on, which was full of sound and interesting stuff, and then back to another the anchor. So every 45 seconds, every minute, you were changing the voice people were listening to, and that's how they framed a five-minute newscast. Well, our five-minute story was also changing sound, and we were fighting for the attention of the listener. And it's I'd like to say, no, Americans are all ready to sit down and listen to a 12-minute monologue, but it's not true. That's not my experience of Americans. And so the challenge is, okay, let's fight for their attention. One, you know, minute by minute, second by second, let's produce stuff that sounds good and competes for their attention. The person whom I was doing this with, who brought me to NPR 1,000 years ago, Robert Krulwich, is still doing
Robert
it on Radiolab.
One of the best.
And Radiolab is operating at a pace and a cut that is quicker than anything we were doing in 1977. And young listeners love it. And it's understanding that, yeah, okay, listeners have a short attention span. Let's frame this piece so that the perspective changes very often.
Compelling radio, though, still pulls
yes.
in people, even at length. And I didn't know Robert Krulwich is the one who brought you. That's phenomenal.
Yeah.
I want to thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, Evan. It's been my pleasure.
And our listeners have been thrilled to hear you. And we do miss you on All Things Considered, but wonderful perspective. Thank you, Robert.
Thanks
Siegel.
A lot for having me.
The great Robert Siegel with us for this hour. Our thanks to Emma Rae Stein, who is volunteering. No, you're not volunteering. You're interning with us. My goodness. It's Dolores who's volunteering. It's Megan producing and Rob engineering. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a lovely weekend. Talk to you Monday on member-supported public radio.